Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Corbicera, and it is great to be back, everyone. Huge weekend of Six Nations results to react to. Like, boy, oh boy, you know, all live across Peacock TV in the United States. We had the first two games, which was Wales winning in Rome on CNBC, and then England capitulating against the French on CNBC. And then on Sunday, Ireland with a big performance over Scotland. That one was live on CNBC. And before we get into this episode, a reminder that every game this weekend of the Six Nations is live on broadcast television. The first two kick off on CNBC. The final one, England going to Dublin, Ireland playing for a Grand Slam on St. Patrick's Day weekend. That one is live on main NBC. Huge window for the sport here in America. If you are listening to this pod in the States, please tune in and support and tell your friends. It's a great opportunity to see some of the best rugby for absolutely free on the widest audience that you can really provide in America. And before I get into some of my initial reactions to the game, just a reminder of what this show is going to be. We have performance analyst Ross Hamilton on again to sort of review the results on the weekend by the numbers with myself, but also preview the final weekend's round as well by the numbers. Some fascinating insight in that, so stay tuned. But quickly, just want to give my thoughts on a couple of the games. I thought, you know, Wales found a way to finally get the W, looked much sharper with their clinicalness and attack, took their opportunities. Italy had moments, created so much, but inaccuracies and inability to score just was too much for them. You know, they are developing this style, which is turning out good attacking numbers and promising, but maybe it's not quite rounded the corner of the all complete game to actually go out and win these test matches against the top tier ones, even though they have shown they can be competitive. Then let's get on to England v France. Like, I don't know if men versus boys is too harsh, but just the gap between the two sides on that day was quite astounding. And you feel for Borthwick, Genge, you know, interviews after the game, absolutely shell-shocked almost at what they just experienced. And listen, England in a rebuild phase where France just found their form again. Like, France were a team last year, were saying, these are the world champions. These are the world champions. A little bit of a sluggish start to this Six Nations, finally turned it on and showed why they are potentially the world champions. And it also showed where England are just not at the races. I think, you know, they're still not finding a way to score tries. But the big thing for me is the collisions. They are were not able to put dents into the French when they had the ball, and dent the French when the French had the ball. And I think the French's ruck speed in the opposition half when they played against England was just too much for England to handle. And then they have the finishes, the clinicalness, Depot and Intermac, all the threats out wide, power in the middle. Like, they're such a complete team that if you give them like that sort of ball and everything, you're not able to deal with it. I think Borthwick's got to look at this World Cup and think, I might have to think about my selection here a little bit. Obviously, injuries have prevented certain people, but for me, that pack needs more collision winners. If we do not load that pack with more guys who are going to win the collisions, England will not be able to topple the top couple teams in the world. It just becomes so evident when you play a team like France there. For me, I think Genge and Sinclair are absolutely money. I think if anything, there's too much reliance on them as the carriers and the gain line when they have a big responsibility at set piece against the top teams in the world. You know, a stat to me was always told that maybe your props give you across 80 minutes, or your front row gives you across 80 minutes, like 20-odd% of your carries. I think those guys are being asked to do way more than that, especially in the 50 to 60 minutes that they play. You know, the second row, I think Marrow's maybe not his incredible self. He's battling some health issues, which, you know, do play into why maybe he's not performing to his best. And then you've got Chesham there, who's very similar Marrow-esque, absolute operator, gets through so much work. But does he bring the physicality? Does he bring the size at set piece? Is he the lock you want behind your tight head in that position? That's the question mark for me, is it might have to be Chesham or Atoji with a bigger lock, or finding a way to load that pack with a bit more bang somewhere else. I think, you know, unfortunately for me, Dom Brandt is not producing what I need in the eight jersey for an England point of view. I think he has the odd good involvements, and I'm not knocking him as a player, but for the size of the man, he's not stamping his authority on the game with his physicality. And I think that's something that England are missing. To me, I would be shining the Billy Vunipola bat sign up in the air, big BV, just asking for him to come back to Twickenham and you know, finish this season with a World Cup, you know, where I think he belongs in that England side. I think at the moment, he's probably one of the best players there. For that job, I think he just offers more experience. You know, he's going to give you game line and carries and, you know, physical. And he's also a big test match player, which we've seen from him. The other one there, I think Willis, if you're not winning collisions, it's very hard for Jack Willis to have a performance like Jack Willis does, where he is able to nose breakdowns, be into everything, being on the back foot. He almost became a little bit anonymous in that game, where he's an incredible player, but he needs to be in a team, you know, like he's doing at Toulouse or other areas where he's allowed to do what he does well. And I don't think that's happening. Same with Lewis Ludlam, loads of involvements, amazing work rate, but England got a bang again. If you want to know where I think, you know, at seven, if Tom Curry was fit, I would go with him. You know, I'm not sure if Willis is the guy in games like that against the French or not. You know, at six, I think Courtney Laws needs to come back into the mix once he's fit and healthy. And I think that's probably been one of the big issues, is he's not been fit and healthy. And when he's come back, he keeps getting a niggle. And there's question marks there. But that's still England's best back row for me, is Courtney at six, Curry at seven, Vunipola at eight. Haven't seen another one that can match what that team's capable of when they're fully fit. And then I think otherwise, England got to start looking deeper in the depth chart. You know, Tom Pearson is playing incredible at London Irish. I think he would fit this team better at seven right now. He bangs in D. He's electric with ball in hand. He's Caelan Dorris-esque, you know, when Caelan, especially when Caelan's playing more six as well. Just his all-round involvement, athleticism. And then, you know, if we're talking size in the future in the back row, another London Irish player, but Cunningham South, incredible player, incredible talent. You know, you can see the size of the man, still in his infancy, only coming out of the 20s, I think, last year. But again, I would be pinpointing this guy. If it's not for the World Cup, it's after the World Cup. But England got to find some physicality at eight, and I just don't think they're getting that there with Dom Brandt. The back line, you know, Marcus Smith wasn't really able to shine, but a lot of that came from, I thought France defended incredibly, the physicality they brought, but then also the big issues were, is that just the collisions. It's very hard to create tries when you're not getting the ruck speed that you want. And, you know, we'll get into that with Ross Hamilton and some of the stats that back all that up. But that's just my piece now for this England team. I think they need to go back to the drawing board, get through the Six Nations. But when Borthwick gets to that World Cup, he needs to invite all the hitters back. You know, I know this New England, more mobile sort of game plan, I just don't know if you'll be able to beat the top teams without the collision winners that you want. And then that collisions gives your 9-10 game controllers the chance to actually orchestrate the game and make the most of it. So that's really my 10 cents there. I thought Ireland were incredible in their victory in Scotland, really because they faced adversity in the first half, which most games had been done and dusted in the first half. And then they had the ability with no hooker in and, you know, a flanker throwing and Kian Healy scrummaging to just turn the game up another notch and blow Scotland away. Scotland had shot their shots in the first half. Ireland regrouped, turned the intensity up, and were able to go get the W. And that's a sign of, you know, one of the best teams in the world and why they're on the verge of a Grand Slam. And I think thoroughly deserved and very impressive what they've been able to achieve. Now let's get into actually breaking down, reviewing the games, and then previewing the games with performance analyst Ross Hamilton.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the tree of life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And we are joined by the returning Ross Hamilton. Ross, mate, another cracking weekend of games, and I'm sure you've got some cracking insights for us as well. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, good, thank you, mate. Enjoying all the rugby, apart from perhaps the England performance. But the Six Nations as a whole is always fantastic, so still enjoying it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone quite saw the level of dominance that was going to come out of that game from the French, and just the disparity or the gap between the two teams looking so great as it did. We'll save that game because I'm sure you've got some juicy numbers for that, but we'll start chronologically. Let's go to Rome, where Italy were hosting Wales. All the hype was, is this the game Italy were going to win? Bookies had Wales only favoured by a point, which is probably like the best spread I think Italy have probably ever seen in the Six Nations. All the sort of stats were telling this could be Italy's game with Wales' inaccuracies and everything. But what did you make of the game and Wales' ability to score tries finally?
That was the difference for me, Corbs, is the Wales' efficiency, where they had been so poor previously. It was also Italy's weakness. And unfortunately for Italy, they basically maintained the same picture that we've seen so far. Attacking really well, getting some good numbers and some good output, but not converting it. Wales, sort of the opposite. They took the chances that they had incredibly well, far superior to what they've managed before. And that was the difference. And some of the numbers I wanted to show is quite a few, but to show sort of how well Italy attacked and how many chances they had, but it's just not good enough, I suppose. And the fact that they lost this game, everything else that they'd done previously is almost nullified because, okay, very good in defeat. If they won this game, that's a positive. The fact that they've lost this and they're probably going to lose all of them again maybe doesn't quite count so much. But they had a lot of possession time, far more than Wales, 16 minutes to Wales 11. They made 117 carries to Wales' 67, 467 metres made, Wales 290, 11 breaks, Wales just three, made more defenders beat and made more offloads. Their ruck speed was 3 seconds, Wales was 4.7. They had all of that in place. It was all there. There just wasn't that final bit. And there was two parts to that for me. I'm going to talk a lot about this coming shortly, actually, but about kicking and kicking strategies and styles, and whether some people might find it negative or boring, it's a part of the game. Italy kicked 43% of their possession, Wales 86. So double the amount of ball that they kicked away. And that just seems to be the way that you do that, because you get into the right areas if you then can convert. Italy didn't do that. Wales did do that. Italy had more entries into the red zone than Wales, 9-7. However, their efficiency, 1.56, Wales 4.14. We talked about Scotland before and how good 4 points is, how good 3 points is per entry. So for Wales to manage that, which is, again, so different from what they've managed so far, they were averaging around one, then that's a huge disparity for them and the biggest reason of why they got the victory, really.
And when you look at, you know, the game plan from Wales to kick more, like, it kind of made sense because Italy, obviously, we've talked about, they play the most, they kick the least, but they play kind of from anywhere. And a couple of times, that turnover rate when you do play from anywhere can come back to haunt you. And I felt like Wales were quite clever with, you know, keeping Italy in their half. And then they did actually get some reward off some of the turnovers there, as well as, you know, the accuracy when they had their shots. And then, you know, for Italy, there was just so many missed opportunities, like so many missed opportunities out there. Like when you read off those numbers, it's mind blowing. You lose a game when you look at the stats like that. And I guess for them, like in a nutshell, I kind of just felt like they had, like we talked about, it's the first time they'd had the pressure of being not underdogs and not being like, oh, like a valiant performance is basically a win. This was an expectation of a win. And sometimes then you can almost go away from, you know, the nuts and bolts, what you got to do to win. Like, it's, you know, instead of focusing on the win, focus on the things in front of it to get to the win. And I thought Wales just had a better game plan. And like you said, they were accurate for like the turnaround and their red zone conversion rate, phenomenal. And we talked about that Wales were getting to the red zone quite a fair bit, but unable to convert it, where Italy had problems defending teams in their red zone. It all kind of lined up for a solid Wales performance. And, you know, Welsh heads probably held a little bit higher now after being in some dark places, but it's still quite remarkable that just a win against Italy can turn around your perception of a team as well when you look big picture and stuff as well.
Yeah, they're probably scraping the barrel, aren't they, if that is your positive step. I mean, fair play it is, they didn't get the wooden spoon, so that was their measure for this season. But you're right as well in that Italy element of their game style. I think we've seen it all. You can see it in their play that they're very willing to attack from their own 22, and I can just picture Sebastian Negri making big carries from within their 22, and they're playing with it. But that's fine as well for me as sort of an analyst when we're looking at that. If that's on, because you kicked away from your 22 so much and the defence drops their wingers and fullback, then there's space to play. Great. That's heads-up rugby. It seems for Italy it's forced. It's we're going to play no matter what from there. So that when they do make errors and turnovers, which they did, they made 16 possession errors and Wales only made 6. And considering so much of those are within their own half as well, then they are just giving those opportunities to Wales. Wales didn't have to work to get into their 22 very much and therefore take the points. So, you know, Italy arguably killed themselves. They're continuing to do the same thing, is the only thing I might say. Attacking really well, not converting, playing in the wrong areas, getting turned over and conceding tries. So whether that needs to change a little bit or some development from Italy's point of view.
Well, let's put that one in the locker and go to the second game of the Saturday, which just shocked everyone, I think, with the ruthlessness of France. That to me seems much more a France of old that we saw in 2022 type of team playing their game, more than what we've seen so far from them in this Six Nations.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, how clinical and ruthless they were. Some of the tries they scored were fantastic. And I suppose the bit I wanted to start on for England-France was how England are playing. And what we've talked about so far is that they're building and they're playing, they're putting levels onto their attack and their game style. But whether they have done that really, and whether that's going to work, and whether that's enough at international level to be so slow. We've got unbelievable talent and players in this squad who are playing great rugby at their domestic level. We're not sure why they can't sort of apply that to the international scene. But one of my main points is that England kicked the ball 32 times in the game. France kicked it 43 times. So for England, that was 55% of their possession, and France 75%. So we have associated quite rightly that France were electric, scored amazing tries, really clinical, and yet they kicked the ball more than England did. So I think there's just that element that is a part of the game. However, it's an element where you trying to play yourself in the right position, not make errors and turnovers like we've seen Italy do. But when that then turns into your own ball in the right areas, you have to be able to flick a switch and use it and attack with it and do something with it. I wanted to have a look at some of the numbers for the tournament so far, just to sort of show the importance of that. Every team of the weekend who kicks more than opposition won. All three of the winners of the games kicked more than England did. So when we think of and perceive of this England team as a Leicester-style Steve Borthwick kicking, maybe get the ball back, they didn't even do that. However, if they do that, they then have to do something with the back off the back of it. But again, sort of tournament-wide stats, 11 of the 12 teams who have won, so 11 out of the 12 games that have been played so far, the winning team has kicked more than the losing team. Only once that didn't happen, it was Italy who kicked one more time than France did in their round one match, and not even a big disparity between that. So you're such a big proportion of the teams. are winning if you kick the ball more. However, I know that that does sound boring and that may sound a little negative. So I also had a look at some of the attacking outputs, which have to be matched to it, that have to join it. 9 out of the 12 winners have made more line breaks than their opposition. 11 out of the 12 have a better red zone efficiency. It was actually Italy, again, that same game versus France, who had 0.4 points better per entry than France, but had 5 fewer entries. So that was the difference there. But then that takes me back to the game on the weekend of where England didn't do anything, didn't have that game plan of kicking and therefore being pragmatic, but they also didn't have any kind of output. So they made 116 carries. France had fewer. England made 1 line break and France made 8. So I wanted to have a look at the sort of comparison of the efficiency of that. Now, it doesn't take a maths genius to work out that that is 116 carries per line break for England. For France, 109 carries and 8 line breaks means they made a line break every 13.6 carries. Obviously, that's a world apart and completely different. And just to show that they're trying to do something with the ball, their ruck speed was 3.3 seconds. England's was 4.2. They made 11 entries to the red zone, England 8. Their red zone efficiency was 4.55, England 0.88. The disparity between that is crazy. The red zone success, England only converted 13% of the time they got into France's 22, France 73%. The world apart between those numbers is crazy. And just to sort of link those two points in together at the end is that France kicked a lot more. When they had their opportunity, they turned it on. Their attack was phenomenal and they scored. England had neither of those things. So where do we go from here? Is that a step back now? Do we feel like we're back at square one? I don't know, but it doesn't feel like a positive step.
No, I agree. And I think it's, to me, some questions that England have to figure out around their identity. Like, you know, what type of team are they, where their selection is, and what way they want to go? Because I'm curious to get your insight, but from just looking at the game, they were losing far too many collisions. Like the ability of the French to slow them down in defense and have some ruthless defensive sets was something that I think had been missing for them in the competition so far. I think they'd scored 9 tries but conceded 9 tries coming into that game. And then they have the ability to actually defend like that, to keep their penalty count reasonably down, to muscle England. And then also when they had the ball, just create game line and quick ball when they needed to put England into sort of a world of pain.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is just sort of anecdotal of me watching the game and my opinion, but I can't sort of remember players standing up and doing something game changing. You can play within the systems, of course, and that's important. You need the structure to go with it. But there was an Elish Genge tackle on his sort of opposite number in Cyril Bailly, where he just melted him one-on-one. And that's sort of the only thing I can think of where anybody stood up and did anything. Whereas you can think of a million from France's team. Antoine Dupont, Penno, Olivon for his try, phenomenal pace and power. And I just don't sort of see anything from the England team. But that's sort of back to my first or earlier point where they're phenomenal players, England players. They do all these things in the Premiership for their domestic clubs week in, week out. So where's the difference and why aren't they able to do that on the international stage? And something as well I saw in the game is that they show up on the television, the pack weights when they sort of come to the first scrum. England had a heavier pack than France. And we consider France being this all-dominant, powerful pack that smashes everybody. Like, well, we've got heavier players. Supposedly that's muscle and therefore more powerful, but in no point did we implement that onto the game, and that's what France did so well, and hence the result.
I did think that was an interesting stat, that stat there when England were heavier. When you're looking at the packs, you're like, how, with some of the size they have? But they must be. But that to me is where a lot of the issues are. I talk about it in the beginning episode, but I think they have to go back to the drawing board and some of their selection, especially in the pack and the back row. I just don't know if they get enough bang for their buck from certain players. Dombrandt is a big dude. He probably adds a fair bit of weight to that pack total, but is that translating to involvements, physicality, and stuff around the field that maybe England need in that area, that someone like a Billy Vunipola could bring in my opinion? No. And these are some of the things that have to be looked at before the World Cup. Where's the big picture start? And where does the necessity to be very competitive in 2023 World Cup sort of begin is probably the question marks for England right now. I think the worries are the majority of England tries had come around set piece or come from launches inside the 22. Against France, they weren't in a position to really muscle them in that department. And then they just had no other option. And for me, that attacking, you know, you brought Marcus Smith back in the side. I'm assuming that's a sign that you want to try and score more, create, be a bit more expansive. And yet they're still not unable to find that gear where they're truly clicking an attack. And a lot of that to me does come down to that either inability to not be able to muscle teams like England of old, or not be able to just bang teams in the collisions and generate that quick ball that you do have the time for guys like Marcus Smith to do his magic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The Rugsby one is huge, as I mentioned. You know, they're a second slow on average than France were. And it is down to those players for me, I'm going to say it. I know a lot of the guys in Steve Borthwick from my Saracens days have sort of worked with those guys. So going through the team, Jamie George, is he as good as he was before? Is he standing out and making game-changing performances? Is Maro Itoje anymore? Lewis Lullum is a fantastic player and he's a workhorse, but does he have those game-changing moments at international level? Don Brand the same. Jack Willis, has he performed as well as we know he can do? Perhaps not. So, you know, some of those players, if they're not doing those things, maybe there's a chance that they still need to get some game time and more opportunities to do them, but they have to do that. Or there are other options, because you're right. If you don't get these guys on the front foot, what's the point of having Marcus Smith there? Because you're not going to be able to do anything. The one line break that we had was his by foot. It's not that he's creating something. He just had the space that he went himself. So I agree with you there. Maybe some change needs to happen.
When you look at France, they'll probably be kicking themselves that they couldn't sort of find some of this form when they played that game in Dublin, but they still do have a chance in the tournament. And it just shows, you know, we've been talking about France all last year as the potential winners of the World Cup. And then we moved on to Ireland, like our shiny new toy, because they've been looking so sensational. But France just kind of like reminded everyone, hey, lads, we're still here. Like, we're still here. We still got it. When we play like this, you know, good luck trying to catch us, sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, they've certainly got that. I've got some stats for sort of their matchup this weekend as well, and how they strike and how quickly they are in attack. It's phenomenal. So they're still a threat, of course.
Let's wrap these reviews up then so you can get to that stuff. So that's two games done on the review. Final game of the weekend saw Scotland host Ireland in, you know, what was potentially the game that could decide the direction this tournament went. And what I found incredible about it was the start that Scotland had. The ability to repel Ireland early in that 22. Didn't concede a try in that first 10 minutes, so we know Ireland are deadly. Then went down there and actually flexed and had their shots. Kept in the game in that first half, showed very competitive. But then I would love to know what the team talk was for Ireland at halftime. Like, genuinely, what happened? And then the sort of versatility and ability to weather, you know, losing your hooker, and how they managed that from a throwing to scrum point of view. Like, That's an example of one of the best teams, if not the best team in the world, and how you respond under pressure, to me, with that performance.
I agree. Their second half was phenomenal. Very close game, obviously, at halftime, very close game. And we sort of pointed that out in the previews, that Scotland are going to have a chance. They're a very good side. It was just Ireland's completeness, I'd say, as a team that just took them away in that second half. And some of the stats as well represent how close Scotland were in that and how well they performed. They only made one line break themselves and Ireland made six, but then they beat 21 defenders and Ireland only beat 10. So they had their strengths in sort of different ways between that. Scotland had a better gain line success than Ireland did. So they got over the gain line more than Ireland did, which is not something you perhaps would relate. Their ruck speeds was very similar. Ireland's were 3.2, Scotland's was 3.4. One thing I'll mention on that, Jamison Gibson-Park came back for this game, came on at 53 minutes. Ireland's ruck speed for the game up until he came on when Conor Murray was playing was 3.4 seconds. For the period that Jamison Gibson-Park was on the pitch, their average was 3 seconds. So that's 3 seconds per ruck, every ruck, from 53 minutes on. When the majority of those guys have played a lot of the game, they're tired. Increasing your ruck speed in the second half to that kind of speed is crazy, and I think was the difference in where sort of Ireland got their edge and they pulled away. I think you could see it as well if anybody, fans at home watching this, and watch Jamison Gibson-Park when he's playing. I expect him to play on this weekend coming up. how quickly he's at the ruck and the breakdown. He's just lifting that ball and going away. He made 89% of his total touches in the game were passes. So we look at his runs, his kicks and his passing, and 89%. So it's a huge percentage even for a scrum half. So all his job is to get the ball, get in there, get the ball, get it away. And that's what he does. And he does it so well. And again, it, for me, it was the difference in that second half of where Ireland pulled away. They had a red zone efficiency of 2.8 across the game, and Scotland was 1.4, so half. So not quite where they were in their previous standards. As we mentioned, they were very tough to manage that from rounds one and two. They couldn't translate that into three and four. One thing for me as well, we talk about efficiency and Ireland especially being sort of clinical and ruthless. They average two penalties in their attack per game. They actually made zero on the weekend. So not a single one of their possessions did they give up easily with a penalty conceded. That, as well as, you know, converting in the red zone, it matches efficiency for me, that they just use their ball so well. Everybody knows their job. So that means nobody's got turned over at a breakdown, not even once, and conceded a penalty, because everybody knows their job, they're in the right place and they're doing the right things. That, to me, is that clinical edge. We can tie that into Josh van der Vlier throwing in and Kian Healy scrumming at hooker. The ability for those guys just to know their job, slot into place, everybody else can manage it, just phenomenal.
And I think as well, phenomenal when you think the pressure on them, you know, the expectation, the Grand Slam looming away from home, no hooker, issues to be faced, and they go on and just turn the gear up the other way. I was very, very impressed. And I think that's a great point you make about Gibson Park coming on and changing the game. Maybe not as, you know, noticeable a thing in real time, but just that ability to up the tempo, which is what Ireland seemed to do. They just seemed to have another gear that they were able to reach, where Scotland had kind of thrown the kitchen sink at them in that first half and then just couldn't find an answer or get their rhythm to be able to take control of the game. I do think it was an odd decision when Scotland changed their front row. You know, I was just shocked that they swapped their props as early as they did. I did think they had a decline there at set piece, which, you know, helped swing the game towards Ireland. But on a whole, Scotland are a team that, you know, they show promise, they create opportunities, but really the clinicalness which hit them in the round one and two seems to not be there come round three and four.
Yeah, and with the sort of set piece element of that, obviously Josh van der Vlier came on throwing for pretty much a half, almost all of it, I think, actually. They did lose four lineouts across the game, but their lineout success was 78%, with a half of Josh van der Vlier, their number seven, playing hooker, throwing the ball in. Scotland lost five lineouts, and their lineout success was 58%. With a genuine hooker for the whole game. So you got to think that you can't match those levels. If you can't match Ireland with a back row throwing in, then where's your set piece at? And that forms such a big part of your platform and your launch and where you're going to get into your red zones and score tries from and so on and so on.
Makes perfect sense, mate. Let's wrap that game up and let's get into the previews for this weekend, as it's the final weekend this Saturday. All three games here are live across. First two are on CNBC, and then the last one, Ireland hosting England in Dublin, is live on NBC. Massive showcase for the sport. Let's go chronologically. Talk us through what you've got for some of these matchups.
Yeah, just a little one on Scotland-Italy to start. Again, almost giving Italy a chance with a big if. As if they take their chances, I think that's clear to say now that they haven't done that so far. But actually, because of how Scotland defend as well, I found something quite interesting with them. So Scotland have had to make the most tackles so far in a tournament. They also miss the fewest. So therefore, very obviously, they have the best tackle success. However, their defence is very passive. They don't go out and make big shots or chop tackles or anything at all. They make the fewest chop tackles, the fewest dominant tackles. Just 4% of their tackles are dominant. So it's almost about soaking up the pressure rather than going out and trying to change the game by those big hits. Now, if you link that into sort of what they do off the back of that with the breakdowns as well, they don't attack those defensively. They win the fewest turnovers per game, just 5.3 from the breakdown. And they also allow their opposition the fastest ruck speed, so an average of 3.35 seconds for Scotland's opposition. Now, that ties directly into Italy's attack and how well they might be, with a caveat of obviously converting that. Italy have made the most post-contact meters, 140 meters post-contact in around that contact area in the tournament. The most line breaks, 8.5. Second most defenders beaten, second most offloads, and they have the fastest ruck speed. They have a faster ruck speed than Ireland do. When we talk about how ruthless and clinical they are, Italy are averaging 3.19 seconds for all of their rucks. It's phenomenal, and you can kind of completely understand why you're making so many line breaks and defenders beaten. However, the big issue, not converting it. Not even getting into the right areas that much. The fifth most entries into the 22, just over seven times they do that in the game. Their efficiency is 2.07, it's second best, and their success in there is 35% against second best. So that is a big element, of course, and we know that. We haven't seen anything from that of Italy of whether they can change that. If they can focus on that, they might have a chance. The only thing I'd say back in contrast to that is, although Scotland are very passive and they don't sort of attack the breakdowns too much, they don't give themselves situations where they're under so much pressure and there's chaos from line breaks or anything. They concede the fewest themselves, just 4.5. And they've conceded the second fewest points per game, just 21. So that passive defence, you would argue, seems to work for them in defence. So maybe they are capable of holding out Italy where it matters. However, Italy may have a chance if and when they can finally do something in the red zone.
It's crazy, the small margins and just like the conversion rate of those entries and the accumulating effect they can have on a game. We've talked about it before, but it's fascinating. So, all right, that's that game done and dusted. On to the next one, which sees, you know, France still have hopes in this tournament. If England can pull off a miracle, they'll come to play Wales absolutely swinging. What do you make of this matchup and how these two teams line up?
Yes, I mentioned it a little bit in the sort of reviews of how France strike and how ruthless and clinical they are with their possession. So I had a look at a couple of things. We have a stat with our try sources, so where the possessions originate from, and then we have a tries by phase, how many phases it takes those teams to score those tries. France have scored the most tries from broken play. They scored the most tries from turnovers, 5, and the most from kick receipts, 3. They also scored the most tries on the first phase, which is 8. They've scored the most tries within 3 phases, so 4 more on top of that. That equates to France as 75% of all of their possessions, all of their tries, sorry, are scored within 3 phases. So their strike element is fantastic. We mentioned, we showed versus England, they kick the ball away a lot. They still do. They're still playing smart. They're still playing the right areas. When it's on, it's on. Also, again, in contrast to Italy, that maybe they're not doing that, is when it's at the right time, they will strike and they will go. So those numbers show how dangerous they are in those positions, in that transition defence, as we sort of tend to call it from a Wales point of view. And some of the stats, obviously, to link that and show how clinical France are in attack. Second most metres made, but then the 6th, so the fewest, in contact. They don't want to play in around those tight areas. They don't want to play where there are bodies. They want to find space and get across the game line and make their line breaks from there. They beat the most defenders with 26 per game, the most offloads with 14. So they obviously have that element. And then just another sort of link back to how often they kick and how well they manage their game. They make the second most kicks in play for the most meters, average over 1,000 meters kicked per game. So they know where to play and they know how to do it. When they go, they really go. And that sort of epitomized for me in their ruck speed. They have an average ruck speed across the whole game, across the whole pitch of 3.7 seconds. And that puts them in 4th. When I looked at that between the halfway to the 22 and then the 22 to the try line, so the opposition territory, they are the fastest by a mile. So the speed that they increase their rucks from when they get into the right areas is phenomenal. Their average ruck speed in the opposition half is 2.4 seconds. When it gets into the opposition 22, it's 2.3 seconds on average per ruck, which is a phenomenal speed.
Yeah.
And then the second element of that, we also have a look at how many rucks are under 2 seconds. 2 seconds is sort of the holy grail for rucks and how quick you want to aim for to be able to disorganize your defense enough. In the opposition 22, France have 54% of all of their rucks under 2 seconds. Over half of all their rucks are less than that. I mean, as a defense, what can you do? The answer is yeah. They end up scoring all their tries. But that's the sort of test that Wales face.
And it's fascinating. Is there anything in the numbers from a Welsh point of view that they can hang their hat on or hope to lean on to try and get a victory?
One very small element, and it is actually in direct contrast to that. So I don't want to be negative for any Wales fans watching, but, you know, they haven't been good. Even their performance from the weekend hasn't sort of raised their overall levels and averages across the tournament. They have the lowest red zone efficiency of anyone, the worst line-out success, the worst scrum success, the most penalties conceded. They make the fewest meters, the fewest breaks, the fewest defenders beaten, and they've scored the fewest tries and points. So it's not looking good from that point of view. But as your question sort of states, is where is the hope for them? And I think it is actually in contrast to France's style and way of attack. France score more tries from broken play than they do from set piece. They're the only team that do that. So you could argue there's an element that they rely on those errors and turnovers from their opposition rather than building and creating something themselves. Wales are incredibly good at defending that transition, so the broken play. They've conceded just four tries from broken play in total, which is the second best, just one from a turnover, two from a kick receipt, and then one from a tap, which is included in that as well. And the other thing as well that they do very well, again, also not very good at defending opposition breakdown in total, but when they are in their own half, their ruck speed, their opposition ruck speed, sorry, is very, very slow. So they don't allow their opposition to get that momentum within their own half. So they may well be well set up to match and counter France's attack speed by slowing their ruck down. They slow the ruck down of their opposition more than anybody else within their own half and their own 22. So I mentioned France's average ruck speed in the opposition 22 is 2.3 seconds. Wales's oppositions, what they allow their opposition to get, is 3.2 seconds. So that is actually a big gap, nearly a second per ruck within their own 22 when it matters most and you need to get your organisation. So in defence, they might have an element of chance of stopping France. I don't think they necessarily have enough still. I don't think that's particularly bold to say, but they don't have enough in attack either to threaten France. But maybe there's an element of hope there. We can put that out there.
So you're saying there's a chance, but no, not really. It's a tough task. I think Wales and England are both in a little bit of disarray, even though, you know, they've had some victories in the tournament. Both of them, they sort of seem to show, you know, changes in coaches, issues that maybe had gone on previously in this cycle are now coming to fruition with teams that maybe are struggling against some of the teams that are clicking into a World Cup year and sort of peaking in that from an Ireland and a France point of view. And I think Scotland are almost in that bracket a little bit as well. But let's get to the big game, the one this weekend that decides it all. Ireland hosting England in Dublin across St. Patrick's weekend. Is there anything from the numbers that you can see that England can rest their hat on? Or is it, you know, Operation Hope Ireland do not produce what they're capable of?
Yeah, probably the latter of that is there's not much hope, to be honest. There was one thing I thought might be very interesting about this particular game and how they both sort of seem to play. We talk about ruck speed all the time, and I think I would have explained in passing perhaps sort of the importance of that. But if I can sort of do that a little bit more now and to link that into how Ireland and England seem to have played so far. Having a quick ruck means that your opposition's defence is going to be disorganised, unorganised. They can't get set, they're spacing, can't get off the line and come and shut you down. If you can do that back-to-back as well, then the disorganisation builds. And you have players out of position on the back foot, you can then sort of end up making line breaks and then tries off of the back of that. So that's why ruck speed is so important. And we talk about it, everybody talks about it so much. So why that's relevant to this game in particular is because both of these teams score the most tries after seven phases. Ireland have actually only scored two on first phase, the fewest in the tournament, England three. So they both sort of try to build the pressure and build the phases. And then England do it well and they do score a few tries later on. But it sort of, for me, it comes down to just the fact that they've got the ball for so long and it's a little bit slow and they eventually maybe just about muscle their way over. But for Ireland, it seems to be a genuine tactic that they do so well that they create so much disorganisation that eventually there are just spaces everywhere, whether that's with forwards or with flying the ball out to the wing on the edges. And again, so to link those two things in then, so sort of scoring multi-phase tries with their ruck speed, Ireland, as I mentioned, have the second fastest ruck speed in the tournament just to Italy, 3.3 seconds. England have the slowest, 3.9 seconds. So again, they may not seem like a match, 0.6 seconds, but across every single ruck, across a whole game, that does add up to a lot, let alone individually in those rucks as well. So again, that sort of ties a little bit back to me of England having possession, having the chances, they're capable, they're there, but they don't quite do enough with it. Their attack isn't quite potent enough to threaten teams. And I looked at a couple of numbers as well to back that up. Ireland have the second most line breaks in the competition, England the second fewest. And then when I just sort of link those things together again, sort of for a final time, is that Ireland are rapid. Their ball retention is fantastic. They keep hold of the ball. They build their pressure. They break teams down. They score tries. England don't quite do that so much. But Ireland do that at that kind of level, play at that kind of intensity, whilst maintaining their efficiency and their accuracy. They have turned over the ball fewer times than any other team. Average under 10 turnovers per game, which is fantastic. England the worst, so they concede the most, 16 per game. So they're not only not getting their ruck speed, they're not playing at that intensity, but they're also making loads of errors. France play at incredible accuracy with incredible intensity, don't make any errors, and they are getting the rewards, as we've seen. So from that point of view, England don't stand much of a chance so far.
All right, so that's kind of like the attacking side of this matchup done. How do these sides match up defensively?
Unfortunately, not well as well from an England point of view, and almost in a similar way that England, you know, can do some things and they look good on paper, but their output isn't great in defence. So something that might surprise you is that both of these teams have the joint worst tackle success. Ireland have missed the most tackles in the competition. I mean, they're very likely to win the Grand Slam number one team in the world, and yet you miss the most tackles. Both of these teams concede the most meters in contact. So they're not even necessarily the most physical in defence. They're both around 125 meters conceded just in the contact area. Off of the back of that, though, what they both do quite well is they take their opportunities to stop teams where it matters. So you can play 80 meters, you can play phases, you can have as many carries as you want. If that doesn't translate into points and tries, it doesn't matter. And if you stop your opposition in the right areas, that all is irrelevant. And that's what both teams do quite well to a point. Ireland slightly better. Ireland make the most turnovers per game with 8.5. England the second most, 7.5. Both of these teams restrict entries to their own 22 the most. England, in fact, are the best in this one, just 6.5 entries per game, and Ireland allow 6.8. However, where I mentioned that all that is well and good, if it means that you don't concede points, and that's what Ireland do and what England don't do. Ireland have conceded the fewest points and tries per game, 1.3 tries, 14 points. And for England, when you look at those numbers on paper and think, well, that's, you know, really good defence. They don't let teams into their 22 anywhere near as much as anybody else. And yet they've conceded the fourth most tries and points. They concede 3.5 tries per game, nearly three times as many tries as Ireland, and 27 points per game. Again, nearly twice as many points as Ireland. So your defence can look good on paper, or you can be doing some of the right things and it look good. But if it doesn't account to anything, then it's all for nothing. It's very similar to England's attack. Is what is their game plan? What are they trying to do? If you're trying to kick the ball away and play pragmatically, then you have to get some output. If their defence is trying to let teams play and turn them over the right areas, fine, but you can't then concede the tries. So again, unfortunately, two elements of that attack and defence doesn't look great for England.
Oh, fascinating stuff, mate. It's a huge game and huge implications. England need to restore their pride. Ireland need to seal the deal to get the Six Nations Championship Grand Slam wrapped up. And I think it's going to be an absolute cracker. And I just want to say thanks again for your time and all your insight, mate. I think it's phenomenal. I know I'm an absolute rugby nose, so I eat it up. But there is a strong part of our listenership that really loves this and appreciates it. So thank you so much, mate. And we'll probably have to get you on just to react to some of these results and the numbers as well after the weekend. But cheers again.
Pleasure, mate. Thanks for having me.
And that is a wrap on this week's show. Thank you, everyone, for listening, for supporting. Really appreciate it. Lots of cracking insight in there as we get into the final weekend of Six Nations. A reminder to everyone that is live across the broadcast television in the United States. First two games on CNBC. Last game live on NBC. Fantastic for Ireland going for the Grand Slam against England. Don't miss it. But from all of us at NBC, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We appreciate the support and we'll see you again next week.
Mm-hmm. Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.